What shall we say? Shall we call it by a name? I guess we'll call it the Hoban Minute, recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in downtown Denver, Colorado. I'm your host, Eric Singular, and as always, sitting alongside Bob Hoban, president and founder of the Hoban Law Group. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, but I have to take exception to the way you describe that. As always, as if I'm just sitting here, as if you can't get away from me. As always, I'm sitting next to you. No, things are good. I mentioned to you, I traveled on an airplane for the first time last week, for months, and interesting experience. But it was also an opportunity to see how different parts of the country are dealing with COVID in terms of regulations and normality of sorts.
I did as well. So where did you travel to?
So I was in Atlanta, and I was in Washington D.C. and Baltimore. And then at the end of the week, I was in Southern California, L.A., Ventura, Santa Barbara. The last part of the week were college tours for my daughter, who's a senior in high school. And it wasn't formal college tours because every campus is just empty, particularly in California. But that was the best we could do.
Yeah. Well, and just getting to a couple different states, what was the different feeling?
Well, again, it reminds you how good, I guess, is the right word. We have it here in Colorado where, things are relatively stable. Things are relatively normal in terms of, be able to go to restaurants and, people get out and sort of do what they would normally do in a Colorado summer. That, of course, is going to change in the fall, but That was one of the things that I noticed first off. In Georgia, of course, they were one of the first states to loosen restrictions. Things were unusually normal in some of the places I visited there. Then Maryland was a little bit different, and D.C., some of the cities there. I was in Annapolis, and I was in Washington, D.C., The things had been open for a little while, but people are starting to just get used to it, gathering in places, restaurants, bars, and the like. And then California, of course, California is only recently beginning to, slowly but surely open up restaurants for indoor dining and things of that nature. So to see people's behavior, to see the amount of traffic on different roads, particularly in Los Angeles. I drove from Santa Barbara, Ventura, we'll call it, to LAX in a little more than an hour and 10 minutes, which is usually 2 hours to be kind if you do it right. So interesting to see some of those patterns, but it still makes me wonder where everybody is. There's people on the roads. People are not in the cities, based on my observation, necessarily, in terms of major workplaces coming back. Is everybody really at home? Eric, I don't know where they are.
I'll tell you one thing. Up in North Dakota, if you go around wearing a mask, you're like that guy with the mask. Whereas here in Denver, if you're not wearing the mask, you're that guy. So it's interesting to see how that guy designation switches wherever you are.
I was that guy a couple different times. In Georgia, I was that guy with a mask on. And then in Los Angeles, walking on a beach with my wife, with no one else around, someone said something from afar that I didn't have a mask on. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you, just being in California, and obviously we've heard so much about the wildfires, was it fairly smoky? Was it hazy? What was your interpretation being there?
Well, we were on the coast the entire time, so we flew into Los Angeles Airport, LAX, and then drove to, we went up to the UCLA campus and drove up the coast. The coast was, the air quality was just fine because of the breezes, because of just, being so far away from things. However, flying in, we did fly over the fires coming in and going out, the ones in Southern California. And it's pretty, when it's in your face like that, it's really real.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, we could talk about this all day. We could just talk about the all the different things happening in all the different states, because it is fascinating to do a little bit of traveling right now, and being on an airplane was definitely a weird experience. But there's I don't know, people want to talk to you. That's what I noticed. You know, everybody's just giddy to talk to somebody. You know, all the people that we were on the airplane with, just, where are you guys going? What are you doing? Hemp, what's that? You know, so that was fun. But well, there's some big news in the world of law, which is of course what we do here at the Hoban Law Group. There was the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the notorious RBG is one of her nicknames, of course. And it's a big deal when a Supreme Court justice dies. It opens up a vacancy. Obviously, we've already had President Trump appoint one new Supreme Court justice in his first 10 years president. And now this is a hotly debated issue. But where do you...
Two. Gorsuch and Kavanaugh.
Oh, wow. Okay. So are we going to go three for three? Where do you sit on all of this? Tell us a little bit about your impression of RBG. Everybody's, you know, been... we've seen a lot of that over the last week, or I guess 4 or 5 days. But, you know, give us your sense.
So let's talk about RBG for just a moment, then sort of get to the politics and the positioning of it behind there. You've got, first of all, the only woman on the Supreme Court since Sandra Day O'Connor had left the court, and until Justice Sotomayor joined the court. So there's a long period of time where she was the only female on the Supreme Court. Her background, as most people have read about if they didn't know previously, she's been an advocate for individual freedoms, individual rights, a supporter of female-led initiatives, women's rights, reproductive rights, working with the ACLU for many, many, many years at the highest of levels before she was appointed as a federal court judge below the Supreme Court and ultimately on the Supreme Court. When you're in law school, you sort of get baited into this game of picking your favorite Supreme Court justice. And I wouldn't say that Justice Ginsburg was one of my favorites for no reason other than, you know, you don't know enough going into law school about these people's politics and what their background is. You learn as you go along. So, you know, other more notable judges kind of take that, you know, top two or three ranking, and you know, most people that need to be steeped a little bit in Supreme Court jurisprudence to understand who these people are. And of course, over the course of education, over the course of career, you begin to appreciate people. But her legacy cannot be denied. Wonderful images today for the memorial service, where her law clerks, and this is a long-standing tradition for Supreme Court justices that pass away, their former law clerks receive them. And there's great images on online today of all of her very, very, very successful law clerks. 27 years on the bench, I think it was plus or minus 100 law clerks that, you know, presumably all went on to do very important things in the field of the law. Many became judges, so forth and so on. So that's a striking image that doesn't leave you. Also interesting about Justice Ginsburg is she replaced another Colorado-born and bred U.S. Supreme Court Justice, Byron White, who our courthouse here is named after in Colorado. Byron Wizard White was a football player also at the University of Colorado. And so you've got White, you've got Gorsuch, and then ultimately in contention for Justice Ginsburg's spot is a woman named Allison Ide, who was on our Supreme Court and now is on our 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, although it appears that the president's going to nominate somebody else for that position. But at the end of the day, the legacy can't be denied. Now, let's talk about the politics of this, because this is the interesting thing. I've been in front of a lot of judges. I've worked closely with a lot of judges. It's something that good judges work really, really hard. Good judges tend to be really analytical and methodical in how they meter out justice, and whether that's an individual case or something that has a broader impact, like Supreme Court or appellate judges tend to deal with. I think it's easy for people that aren't lawyers to say that person's conservative and that person's liberal. And certainly things can break down along those lines. But I don't really believe it's because that person is conservative or liberal. It's just that colors their approach to how they interpret the law. Justice Scalia, who did pass away in the last year of Obama's 8th year in office, and who he did not advance, well, he advanced Merrick Garland as a potential nominee, but that didn't go anywhere because of, you know, the Senate gets to control that agenda. Scalia was what they call a textualist, you know. Well, that means he's conservative. And as a man, certainly a conservative man, but a textualist. The words mean what they say. If the words don't say something specifically, I'm not going to read something into that. Whereas the more liberal judges tend to be more activist, or at least they're painted as activists. Well, the law says these things, it doesn't say this, but we can read into this that it meant to address this or that it should address this. And that's where, you know, the most stark or obvious contrast between a conservative jurist and a liberal jurist comes down. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes down. We've got 8 remaining judges. I believe 2 are liberal appointees and the other 6 are conservative appointees. What does that mean for hot button policy issues like abortion, like, you know, reproductive rights, you know, individual rights as it relates to, assessing different classes of protected persons? It has going to have a big impact on that. But I also don't think that these dogmatic judges necessarily just drive or driven by their politics. They're driven by the way that they were trained to interpret the law, which you can easily say, oh, it's the same thing. It's just not. When you're a lawyer, it's not. For example, if you had a conservative Christian judge that would, because of that person's personal beliefs, be anti-abortion, that doesn't mean that that person's going to come down in an anti-abortion way because that's their personal belief. But the textualist approach tends to get to the same place. So I think it's just a lack of understanding, a lack of education from the general populace about what judges do, which is, you know, just based on their lack of exposure to those things. And we'll see how this ultimately does play out. The interesting thing, of course, is in 2016, at the end of Obama's 2 terms in office, the Senate, McConnell at the time, refused to advance the nominee for a vote. Merrick Garland at the time, who remains on the D.C. Circuit, as I recall, if I recall correctly, and probably would have been an excellent addition to the bench, but, you know, that ship had sailed. Gorsuch comes in. Obama didn't appoint somebody because he was out. He was 8 years. He was termed out. It was anybody's guess whether a Democrat or Republican was going to win, and the Senate controlled the agenda, so it wasn't advanced at that point in time. They're moving it forward so quickly now because of political reasons to create a wedge issue for additional voters one way or the other on Election Day, unfortunately. And I do think that you're ultimately going to see a Supreme Court judge, justice on the bench before Election Day, which also is going to make people go nuts a little bit, because if what I believe is true, I believe we're going to have a very tight election. I hate to predict this, but I do feel like somehow, some way, there will be a legal challenge to this election if it is indeed as close as I predict it to be. And that challenge goes where? To the U.S. Supreme Court. So this new justice, in theory, could be asked to opine as to the validity of the election. And much like what happened in Bush v. Gore, a decision came down that, you know, broke in favor of the conservative presidential candidate, the Republican in that case, George Bush at that time. So it's going to be interesting. No one's going to be happy no matter what happens. But it's great to see that our system does kind of still work, even when it's over-politicized. Now, one last thing on the Supreme Court. So the Democrats are saying, well, if the Republicans are going to advance a nominee right now, it's not what we did in the last year of Obama. It's not proper. Let the next president choose that person. What is a little bit different about the Obama situation is Obama was termed out. Trump could in theory, if he wins the election, he was in there for 4 more years. So then the debate becomes, should we increase the number of judges, which is set at 9? Well, that's a dangerous thing because, in effect, if you want to increase the judges, that presumes you're going to be in a position of power after November 3rd or after Inauguration Day in January of 2021. If you're not, you've just floated an idea that could make the court even more lopsided in terms of conservative jurist versus so-called liberal jurist if you increase the number from 9 to, say, 11 or 13 or something along those lines. So interesting to watch it play out. Unfortunately, it is highly politicized. And, you know, if I had to say who my favorite Supreme Court justice is today on the bench, I did like Justice Kennedy for a while, by the way, who's still alive. No longer on the bench. I think Justice Kennedy is excellent. I've always been a big fan of his. But I think Chief Justice Roberts does a heck of a job. He's perceived as a conservative jurist, but he's come down on both sides of political issues. He's not, I'm just going to, you know, put my decision, my opinion based on political grounds. He is a textualist in part, but I think he's been extremely reasonable, and I think he does a very, very, very good job leading the Supreme Court, particularly being named the Chief Justice upon being appointed to the court, which is an enormous task to undertake, and I think he's done it with dignity and grace, despite the fact that those positions unfairly get politicized. That's probably more than you wanted to talk about as it relates to the Supreme Court.
Maybe a little bit more, but actually, really, just to be honest, I think it's very valuable to hear somebody who practices law give an analysis like that. And I say that because I think there's so much focus on the executive and the legislative branch of government, especially from a media perspective, and the mass media and a mass populist awareness of this is how politics works in this country, that actually looking at the judicial branch and talking a little bit more about the textures and colors that make up the decision-making process and how judges who sit on the Supreme Court look at issues, I think there's a lot of value in that, and that it likely is a little bit more complex than just, oh, that's a red or a blue person, the same way that we analyze a presidential candidate or, a senator, congressperson, whatever. But I do want to just highlight, because I thought it was really interesting what you said about the potential implications for, an issue occurring in this election that would raise some kind of legal question. For those more seasoned people in the community out there who are listening, when you reference the 2000 election, that, they know what you're talking about. For people who are more my age and a little bit younger, likely, unless you really have a strong grip on the history of the last 20 years in this country, would you speak just a little bit more in detail about what happened in 2000 and, whether or not that was the first time that the Supreme Court has ever been tasked with actually picking the next president of the United States?
Well, I mean, so at that point in time, the vote count was contested. The vote count was contested in 2000 because, in particular, Florida, there were jurisdictions with these voting forms that created something called a CHAD, meaning you the machine poked through the voting form, and if it poked through it on your candidate was Bush, then the hole should be clear, and you put these things in the machine. But there was something that they called hanging CHADs. In other words, that the paper wouldn't completely separate from that hole. Arguably, it was there's a conspiracy theory about this being a Republican-based printer that made the cards extra thick, and so that one side could get more of the votes if this situation were to occur. Anyway, they had to go in, they had to assess the recount scenarios, and they had to look at the state of Florida and determine based on who won the state of Florida under the Electoral College, based on the popular vote within that state, who got those votes. And of course, despite, just like in 2016, despite Al Gore getting more popular votes than George W. Bush, Bush won the Electoral College, which of course is our system, and that's what the U.S. Supreme Court determined at that point in time. And that's what the U.S. Supreme Court is there for. It's there to decide the highest cases and controversies in the country involving things of great magnitude like that, involving high-level social issues. And of course, many people know this, but the U.S. Supreme Court does not have to take a case to get to the U.S. Supreme Court, you either have to have original jurisdiction, meaning there's a contested presidential election or something that's clearly defined of great importance under the law and that the court can take it on directly. Otherwise, you have to go to a trial court and win or lose. And then that gets appealed. That gets appealed to a circuit court, an appellate court. You win or lose there. And then you have an opportunity to file a petition for cert, as they call it, certiorari, saying, hey, Supreme Court, you should take this case because it's really important and here's why. And the Supreme Court takes a small percentage of those cases, only the most controversial issues, which is why, going back to why the court becomes politicized, despite the fact that I do believe most Supreme Court judges, despite who appointed them, have been really responsible, respectable jurists and have not worn their politics on their sleeves. Those things come up because they can take cases that are controversial involving, you know, classes of individuals and civil rights, involving, you know, abortion rights or reproductive rights, for example, involving states' rights. There's a number of issues that people are concerned about, and that's what the Supreme Court is there for. Incidentally, being in California last week in Santa Barbara, Earl Warren was formerly the governor of California, a Democrat governor, and was subsequently appointed to the Supreme Court. And the Warren Court shifted American politics and American policy from a legal standpoint dramatically. I taught this at the University of Denver for years, so this is extremely interesting to me, but I won't belabor the point for the purposes of our podcast. The Warren Court was the court that read into, if you will, different pieces of legislation and the absence of legislation, provisions that would give individuals rights, whether they were female, male, female, gender rights, whether they were rights between different members of different races, whether they were rights between, you know, who's allowed to vote and who's not allowed to vote. And, you know, these really, really prescient issues that came up at that point in time, the Warren Court was instrumental. Can you imagine there being a truly political appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court, meaning someone who was a partisan, elected a governor in a state, and then subsequently went to the U.S. Supreme Court? I can't imagine that happening. That seems too overtly politicized, but it's happened in the past, which just goes to show that everything we think we're seeing right now, it's so terrible, it's the first time all this stuff has ever happened. That's not true. It's been going on for the history of time, particularly in the United States in politics. And, you know, unfortunately, it gets intensified during election season.
Well, and let me ask you this. Has any cannabis case ever made it to the Supreme Court? Have we seen that happen as of today?
So there is a case called Gonzalez versus Raich, R-A-I-C-H, which talked about, does California, and I'm going to get this wrong because it's been a long time since I looked at it, but basically, does federal law prohibiting marijuana as a Schedule I substance, does that trump or preempt the state law which allows patients to access medicinal cannabis? And in that case, it was not a great outcome. It did say that, yes, that federal law in that context overruled the state law, which legalized medicinal cannabis for purposes of that particular individual in that case. So that's one case that comes to mind off the top of my head. There's, of course, a slew of cases in different circuits that have addressed different cannabis issues, a lot of them, most of them, frankly, resulting from the criminal context. We have not seen a case yet that looks at the Gonzalez versus Raich issues I was just trying to describe as it addresses preemption in this respect. Well, we've got a number of states across the country that have legalized marijuana. We distribute, we dispense, we cultivate, we process marijuana. We don't ship it over state lines. Does that, under a state's rights analysis, does that allow the state to do what it wants if it technically doesn't conflict with federal law, or is that a right that's reserved to the states that the states can then legislate on their own despite what federal law says. That's this known as sort of preemption or conflict of laws scenario. So that's the case that everyone's very interested in. There's one case at the Supreme Court right now on a petition for cert, Washington v. Barr. Marvin Washington, former NFL player, along with a number of other profiled plaintiffs, suing Barr, our U.S. Attorney General, to basically determine that the Controlled Substances Act is unconstitutional, specifically as it relates to marijuana, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is the disproportionate impact on minorities, on enforcement of the Controlled Substances Act over time, looking at the fact that now, if I'm a professional athlete or a patient, in this case, you can be legal in one state, then you travel to another state and you're no longer legal. That limits the rights of those people to go to national parks, to go to federal facilities, so forth and so on. So there's a number of arguments that are accumulated there. That petition for cert is filed. Our law firm filed an amicus brief in the last week on behalf of some wonderful petitioners that are highlighting reasons that they feel that the U.S. Supreme Court should take the Washington v. Barr case. And if that case is taken by the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court would have to determine whether or not the Controlled Substances Act, in fact, is constitutional for a variety of argumentative reasons that are set forth in those briefs, and whether it should be stricken as it relates to marijuana, which is the relief that they're seeking. That would be a major, major shakeup. Maybe not 100% likely under the composition of this court, but you never know. When you look at textualism and you look at the plain language of statutes and the intent and the fact that marijuana is scheduled as a Schedule I substance, meaning high potential for abuse, no medicinal benefit, plain language would suggest that that doesn't stand muster. And conservative judges tend to look at plain language. So we shall see.
And that is marijuana with an H, is that right, Bob?
Marijuana, yes.
So this has been a fascinating conversation, but in the spirit of celebrating the banking and finance practice area of the Hoban Law Group, let's transition for just a few moments and talk about some of the high-level banking and finance issues that are facing both sides of the cannabis industry. With hemp, we know that last December we saw a memo come out that had a number of different banking and financial institutions basically saying, look, hemp is legal, we can offer banking services to the hemp industry, and yet in the 9-10 months since that came out, we've still seen some challenges. So where do you kind of see the biggest obstacles or roadblocks on the hemp side of the industry right now as it relates to banking?
As oftentimes pointed out by mainstream media and participants in the industry, the lack of reliable, consistent, institutionalized banking leaves a smoking crater, just a void that the industry really needs to get over. So we've had strange ways to fill that gap. You've had state-based community or credit unions going out and effectively franchising themselves across different states. You've got uniform laws at the federal level that say that you must KYC, know your customer, meaning know who they are, how they generate their money, is it legal, and there has to be reports filed for suspicious activities. So banking in this industry presents a lot of problems for the banks themselves because it requires additional compliance and significantly additional paperwork. It leaves holes in merchant services, credit card processing, which means you have to go to aggressive, high percentage rate processing services or online services or apps such as Square or the like, who have their own private policies in terms of whether they're going to hold money or what they're going to determine is activity that complies with their member or service agreement or not. That creates problems for the industry. And think about just basic banking services. Depository institutions, a place to deposit your money. That's all the industry has now at a bare minimum in most places, still not everywhere. But it's those other things, as we've talked about in the past, that really That's what the industry needs. It needs lines of credit. It needs the ability to obtain loans for capital improvements or expansion or even real estate, oftentimes associated with the industry. Access to institutional capital, banks that underwrite initial public offerings, IPOs, or that govern that process, they're not available right now to this industry by and large. And that really is the crux of what needs to change if this essential industry is really going to be here to stay and leave its mark for what we're seeing happen all around the rest of the world, but in North America.
And we do have wonderful attorneys here at the Hoban Law Group who specialize really in that area, whether that's helping businesses identify a banking institution or banking services, as well as actual banking institutions who don't understand what the heck this industry is and who's operating legally and illegally. But I want to come back to something you said, which is the depository aspect. How much in the history here in Colorado, in the marijuana side of the industry, and probably the early days of the hemp industry, where people were running around with bags of cash. I remember this great little 10-minute documentary I watched in the early days of legal cannabis here in Denver, where there were just armored vehicles, because they're moving around large amounts of cash with when dispensaries did not have the ability to process credit card transactions. So when you shift over from hemp, which, you know, these businesses should have this access given all of the language that's in the farm bills and the enactment of essentially a policy in our country where hemp is indeed legal and defined separately. Where do you see the marijuana side of the industry as it relates to banking? You know, it was a big step when you could walk into a dispensary and pull out a credit card or a debit card and run a little transaction. And it's always been a little weird because the guy at the thing's like, well, I'm going to run it for $5 more and then I'll give you back the change. And it's like, all right, whatever you got to do, man.
Right, sure.
But, what's the next step, I guess, for the banking and finance side of the legal marijuana or recreational medical marijuana industry here in the U.S.
Well, remember, a lot of that's done through cash anyway, so you do have cash deposits that are substantial with a lack of just widespread merchant services, although, to your point, they're available, debit card systems, everybody's got ATMs on site. But what happens to cash money when it's around cannabis? Do you know? It starts to smell. What's it smell like? It smells like skunks. This is a problem in the industry. It sounds funny to talk about it, but if I'm in a bank depositing my paycheck and in line next to me is somebody making a commercial deposit with a sack of cash, maybe it's, $20,000 of cash, which isn't a lot in terms of volume, that cash smells substantially like cannabis. So think about that for a moment. That has been one of the troubling points for banks that bank this industry, because they've even said, not launder money in the illicit sense, but they've said, you have to launder that money before you bring it in here. What do I mean by launder that money? Literally, and these days have changed dramatically, but literally you'd put the money in a dryer with Febreze sheets to remove the skunk smell. Because then you'd go into a bank and you wouldn't draw that attention, which is really what the banks are concerned about. What's the future of marijuana banking? Well, we've talked at length about, and I've written about the Banking Act at the federal level, which, at least has a chance or was discussed as being part of the second round of coronavirus relief. That Banking Act is necessary. Something like that is necessary, because that would make sure that the marijuana-related businesses have a place to deposit their cash, to deposit and maintain books and records. Why wouldn't government officials want marijuana businesses to have every penny that is sold, paid, deposited, tracked to the penny through banking systems? It doesn't make sense to me. It's a holdout from, well, maybe this stuff is just going to go away if we continue to ignore it and treat them like second-class citizens. But it makes good public policy if banks were to open up and if the federal government were to loosen restrictions so that every business that's regulated at the state level in this industry has those precise, down-to-the-penny banking records, which make sure that all taxes are being paid properly from a government interest perspective. It makes sure that no dollars are being diverted into the black market, or taxes are being avoided, or at least it goes towards those efforts. So banking is necessary. It's in the government and policymakers' best interest. It's in the public's best interest to have banking. And last but not least, think about those large-scale cash deposits and the inability to transfer those to electronic form. That's a safety issue for those marijuana or cannabis business employees going in with large sums of cash on a regular basis, not getting picked up in armored cars, but rather getting thrown in the back seat of the Subaru and driven down to the Wells Fargo. So that is the lay of the land, Eric, is as I would say, of what's happening with banking and what's needed with banking, and why it's really in the best interest of our government to ensure that marijuana businesses, above all other businesses, have access to banking services, because it provides greater accountability, which is what policymakers and the general public want from a new controversial industry.
Well, and you can stay up to date with all of the newest updates and developments in the banking and finance sector of the cannabis industry, whether that's by following Mr. Hoban on Forbes and all the wonderful content that you're putting at, or going to the Hoban.law website and going to the practice group and signing up for our weekly newsletter, which this week is highlighting banking and finance. And we have all of our attorneys putting out great blog articles and other pieces, just kind of tracking these changes and these high-level discussions and dialogues around what's going on in the industry and what is needed to get us to the next step. But as you say, the U.S. cannabis industry needs banking now. It needed it yesterday, but tomorrow is
Tomorrow we'll have to do.
Yeah. Well, what can you say? Can you call it by a name? You can call it by something. From all of us at the Hoban Minute, we're signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.